You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert on curse words, about why it seems like swearing is getting more common in the workplace and elsewhere. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with the answer to a Wisconsin question about polka.
We recently received a couple questions from listeners about Wisconsin's love affair with polka, like this one.
My name is Josie Dunn. I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Mineral Point, Wisconsin.
She asked,
how did the polka become a dance and a tradition?
And when I think about polka in Wisconsin, I think of one guy, second-generation Wisconsin and International Polka Association Hall of Famer, accordion wizard, and bandleader, Steve Meisner.
Hi, this is Steve Meisner, and I am a full-time musician living in Whitewater, Wisconsin, the land I love.
And here's Steve's quick answer.
Well, it started in Bohemia, and then the dance is invented, okay? And so that was spread throughout Europe as a dance, and it was, in its day, like rock and roll.
But Josie says she'd like to know a little bit more.
Because I know the polka is important to Wisconsin because it is the state dance, and I want to know a little more about it.
Steve?
It's woven into the fabric of our lives in this state. It's really in Wisconsin because of the rich European heritages that are in Wisconsin.
Okay. Like?
It spread from Bohemia, through Poland, Czech Republic,
Germany,
Switzerland,
the Alps region.
The Dutchman style. The Polish style is completely different.
Whereas like the Slovenian style, or what I call the American Slovenian style that I do, is more melodic and has more of a swing feel.
Ah, okay. So, but what about the dance?
The Polish hop is the most prevalent in Wisconsin, which is part of the original that's from the old country. But like if you go to see Dutchman and Czech bands, you'll see more of the older folks doing like the two-step foxtrot, you know, sort of stepping with the polka versus the raucous, you know, Polish hop style, which you'll get more with the Slovenian style and the Polish style.
But what's the learning curve on the whole dancing part?
Just let me just say that, you know, a lot of the people that want to learn that weren't raised with it, learned, you know. But for the average person, they just get out there and they just jump around. The greatest thing about polka music is it's forgiving. You know, like even my grandkids, I mean, they just love to get out. As soon as they hear the music, they just start getting a little bouncing going, you know, and they just want to get out there and do it.
So just how important do you think polka is to folks in Wisconsin?
It's very, very important to them. We have regular places that we play it all the time that are, you know, in certain areas like the Hiawatha Bar over in Sturtevant, and it's a part of their lives every month. If they miss a dance, they feel bad, you know. I've had generations of college students come out to Madison and say, we came back for a reunion. Do you remember us from 10 years ago, you know? And we danced here all the time. We were here every time you played here. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I remember you guys.
So how does it feel being a Polka Hall of Famer from Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really is an honor because I'm hanging right there with my dad, of course, and Frankie Yankovic. And, you know, I mean, it's been a part of my life, my whole life, you know? So, I mean, truly, it's an honor.
And a little opening do for you right here in Pulaski, Wisconsin, with Steve and the boys. Thank you very much.
This story came from audience questions as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Now, our broadcasting license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, and that's okay. But swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop a profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it seems to have become more commonplace in other environments as our social and cultural norms change. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. I talked to him earlier this year. Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear. And children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you know, like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally, the categories of words that become taboo. And the English-speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The four-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation, and they're policed by what I call the institutions of power. Like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a 5-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, you know, occasionally say, you know, the 4-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, what, like, is do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents, and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. You know, don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the, I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. You know, like, why are you using this word? Are you angry? You know, you can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years is the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. You know, you want to be, if you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it. But if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the four-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I got to ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not
no,
one
I
of
was,
the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with her a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some of those languages, And this made her feel more comfortable bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob,
have at it.
That is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. certainly if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes. And what he reported is happening. What is happening is there, in a nursing home, you have sort of, with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood. And the people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits. And they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings, and where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia. I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common, along with other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures. Somehow, for one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we happen? We use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden. And there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word. Those words have been around for 1,000. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that, obviously, today is the expansion of hip-hop culture around the world, globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip-hop from music and other genres of hip-hop. And they, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well, but my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on, are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles. And where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where what happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here. Or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners, support public radio. I do.
That was Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. I talked to him about why it's getting more appropriate to swear over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how can we get really good at a new skill? We'll get advice from the author of the new book, The Real Work, on the mystery of mastery. And the host of the comedy podcast and TV series Comedy Bang Bang has a new book out. We'll get a sneak preview with Scott Aukerman. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we examine the standards for self-defense. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen young people being shot for pulling into the wrong driveway, ringing the wrong doorbell, and opening the wrong car door. We'll find out what the law says and doesn't say after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay that allows the abortion drug mifepristone to remain on the market. A law professor helps us understand the case and where it goes from here. First, 16-year-old Ralph Jarl was shot in the head and the arm when he went to pick up his younger twin brothers on April 13th. He mistakenly went to 115th Street instead of 115th Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri. 2 days later, April 15th, 20-year-old Kaylin Gillis was shot and killed after pulling into the wrong driveway in rural upstate New York. On that same day in South Florida, an 18 and 19-year-old were shot at after trying to deliver groceries and pulling into the driveway next door to their destination. Last Monday, two high school cheerleaders were shot after one of the girls accidentally tried to get into the wrong car outside of Austin, Texas. And last Tuesday, a man in North Carolina shot at a 6-year-old and other family members after a basketball rolled into his yard and neighbors came to retrieve it. Charges have been filed in most of those incidents. The string of shootings of apparently non-threatening people has raised questions about U.S. and state laws on self-defense, as well as things like stand your ground and castle doctrine laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the string of shootings you may have seen in the news? Do you have questions about what does and doesn't constitute self-defense under federal or state law? Where do you think that line should be drawn? Do you worry about your kids' safety, say, if they get lost or show up at the wrong place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, it's kind of tricky to talk about all these different incidents. They'll have their own way through court as allegations are dealt with. But big picture, John, it seems like these cases, as they're being described in the media, go beyond what we would consider, what the law would consider self-defense. Do I have that right?
Yes, these cases go way beyond what the law would traditionally recognize as self-defense. And I think all of them have kind of one thing in common, which is that there really is no perceived threat, certainly no imminent threat to the people who are resorting to deadly force.
Right. The notion that, OK, somebody is on my front lawn or at my front door or pulling up my driveway, triggering, sorry to use the word, but leading to me shooting at them, that under any law, I think in any state, that alone wouldn't constitute an argument of self-defense?
That's correct. You're really never allowed to use deadly force to protect property. And in all of these cases, the best argument that someone has is that the person was somehow trespassing on their property. And that's not treated the same as, you know, a physical threat of violence. And so you really don't have the right to use deadly force unless you reasonably believe someone is about to use deadly force against you.
Let's talk about some of the self-defense laws around the country. Let's start here in Wisconsin. What we hear phrases like stand your ground and castle doctrine and duty to retreat. What is in place here in Wisconsin?
So Wisconsin does not have a stand your ground law, and Wisconsin does not also have an explicit duty to retreat. And just so people understand,
right,
the law of self-defense grew up around this idea that if you could retreat from a situation, then you were not entitled to use deadly force. If you could avoid using deadly force and still safely remove yourself from a situation where you felt threatened, you should do that. The one exception to that traditionally has been what the law called the castle doctrine, which refers to your home being your castle. And it says that if you are in your home, or you come into your home and you see an intruder there, or someone is attempting to break into your home, you don't have to leave the home. You can stay in your home and use deadly force. And the touchstone in Wisconsin for use of force is the reasonableness of the force in relationship to the threat that you perceive. And also, when we talk about deadly force, the law says that you can use deadly force to prevent great bodily harm or death to yourself, but it has to be to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. And that's the word that the statute that uses, imminent. So it can't be I might be under threat. It has to be a reasonable belief that you are in imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm.
I know when it comes to the police use of force, there are Supreme Court set standards on that sort of reasonable perception. And some of that can feel a little subjective. In what instance could that officer in that instance feel that there was a legitimate threat here? How much does self-perception of a threat? Well, it may not have looked like it to an outside observer, but I felt threatened as a person claiming self-defense.
So the standard really relies on that the reasonableness of that subjective belief. And we can imagine situations where people might have a reasonable belief that someone is about to harm them, maybe even seriously harm them, even if they haven't yet seen the person brandishing a weapon. So an example I like to give about this, if someone has previously threatened you, they've threatened to kill you, they show up outside of your place of employment and reach into their pocket as if they were going to draw out a gun and shoot you, at that point, you might be reasonable for you to think, I need to use deadly force to defend myself. So it's a very case-by-case specific analysis. But you know, again, a touchstone really here is that it has to be a reasonable belief, and the perceived threat does have to be imminent.
Talking to John Gross with the UW Law School, looking at self-defense, the laws around the country where they do and don't apply after a series that I listed earlier of events over the last couple of weeks. people shot for accidentally showing up on a different doorstep than they'd meant to, or in a different driveway than they'd meant to. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, you mentioned the Castle Doctrine, which is in effect in Wisconsin. One that isn't, and I threw out the phrase here, Stand Your Ground Laws of Florida, passed, I believe, the first one in the country in 2005. What does that mean?
So Stand Your Ground Laws typically refer to a statute that changes the law regarding self-defense in that it removes a duty to retreat when you are in a public space. So again, the traditional law was, we don't want you to resort to deadly force if you can safely withdraw from a situation and not use deadly force. The one exception is when we're talking about your home. The Stand Your Ground Laws essentially say, if you are somewhere where you are legally entitled to be, you can use deadly force and there is no obligation for you to retreat, even if you could safely retreat. And so I think a legitimate criticism of these laws is that it really authorizes people to use deadly force in a situation where it's simply not necessary that they do so. And that has led, I think, to some, again, some very high profile cases of people resorting to deadly force when there's a legitimate question about whether or not they just could have shown the person they had a gun and walked away from the situation. And so Stand Your Ground, the essence of the Stand Your Ground law is there, those states that adopt them are removing any duty to retreat, even if it's safe for you to do so.
John, I've spent enough time in bars to see angry disputes that you could envision escalating outside the bar to a point where each side, each participant feels that they are under threat, and each participant could claim self-defense if they escalated the violence further under a Stand Your Ground type law. Is that a concern?
It's very much a concern. I mean, I think the law naturally developed with this idea that you should try to retreat. And the law did that because the law says, in the eyes of the law, right, the preservation of human life is extremely important. And so we don't want to encourage people to resort to deadly violence unless they really feel like there's an imminent threat to their own safety. And so to some degree, these Stand Your Ground laws kind of encourage people to reach for a gun when cooler heads should really prevail.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm so glad you're talking about this. I have weapons training, Madison West Girls Rifle Club in the 60s, and also I've been burglarized at least twice living in New York City. And the conflict I see between the castle theory and self-protection and everything is, if a burglar is entering your home when you're there, and you have the double goal of keeping your family safe, what are you going to do? Oh, excuse me, Mr. Burglar, if you can give me like 3 minutes, I'll go and find my key and unlock the drawer that my pistol is in so I can defend myself. You know, I have to keep it safe from the children. To my mind, you're much more in danger of having your own family injured with your own pistol than from a burglar.
Okay, thanks for the call, Kay, from some personal experience there. John raising a lot of the, ambivalence people might feel about having a gun in the home for self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics show that, people are far more likely to commit suicide with a gun than they are to commit a homicide with the gun. And so we do have an enormous problem in the country about self-harm with firearms. And so there really is, a lot of questions as the caller raises about, does having the firearm in your home really make you safer overall?
Okay, thanks for the call. We're talking to John Gross, clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School, director there of the Public Defender Project, talking about the recent cases around the country of young people being shot after mistakenly entering someone's property without presenting an obvious threat. And looking at self-defense laws in Wisconsin and around the country, what they do and don't allow, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project, looking at recent stories of young people being shot or shot at after pulling into the wrong driveway, ringing the wrong doorbell, or opening the wrong car door. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that string of stories, your questions or thoughts on the current state of self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll go back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I've got a question for your guest. To get a concealed carry weapon, you have to take a safety course. And in that course, there are a lot of issues that are brought up that help one really understand the power of a gun and the power of when and when not to use it. Do you think that requiring everyone, regardless of what kind of gun they buy, to have a course would be a good idea?
Even for people who don't get a concealed carry permit, Michael, I gotcha. John, what do you think?
I definitely think that's a good idea. I mean, I think that just speaks to, you're talking about, you know, people having lethal weapons. Semi-automatic handguns can fire, even in untrained hands, they can fire, multiple bullets in a second. We, of course, make people get licenses to drive motor vehicles because motor vehicles are potentially dangerous and can take a life. And so I think it would be reasonable to also say if anybody wants to exercise their right and purchase a gun or carry a gun, there should be some basic safety and training associated with that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michael. Mark joins us now in De Pere. Mark, hi.
Hello, my name's Mark. I was once walking out of the along the shoreline where the water laps the sand on a county park just outside a county park along Lake Michigan, and one of the people in one of the houses walked out with a shotgun, saying that I was trespassing and that it threatened me. And so I obviously went back off their property. But am I actually trespassing when I'm walking at that place where the water meets the land?
Mark, thanks for the call. John, I believe people have access to that. That's a whole different class of law. But enforcing a perceived trespassing law with a shotgun, that does fit into our conversation, I think.
Yeah, it does. And as I mentioned earlier, you're not entitled to use deadly force to protect property. It's seen as unreasonable to do so, because while property might be damaged or even destroyed, it can be replaced. Somebody's life cannot be replaced. And so trespasses on property or even destruction of property. If somebody were to come into your driveway and, hit your car, with a hammer, you're not allowed to shoot them. They're not directing a threat to your personal safety. And so the law says that's an unreasonable way of enforcing a property right to take someone's life.
Thanks for the call, Mark, and sharing that scary experience. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first question is, if the police come to your door and they don't have a warrant, and you open the door, which maybe you shouldn't, but you open the door to talk to them, and then they put their foot inside the house where you can't shut it, and that would make me frightened. What do you do in that sort of situation?
John, thanks for the call. I'm guessing this would not be a case where you would have a case for lethal force under self-defense, John.
No, you would not. And I think that there's an important distinction here about regarding law enforcement, and even if you perceive law enforcement to be violating one of your rights, if you think law enforcement has illegally entered your property, if you think they've illegally detained you, you can't use force against law enforcement officers. You have other remedies. You can file a civil lawsuit against them for a violation of your civil rights. But the law does not allow you to resist even what you might legitimately believe is an unlawful use of police force with force against those officers. That would be a crime.
Thanks for the call. Ryan joins us now in Amory. Ryan, hello.
Hi. I think that these laws are just dripping with racism. The practical effect is certainly that white people can stand their ground and black people can't. It is so unjust. I asked Philando Castile about stand your ground. He was an NRA member in St. Paul that told an officer he had a gun. The officer instinctively shot him and killed him.
Ryan, thanks for the call. John, have you looked at or thought about the racial implications of our self-defense laws?
There is absolutely the potential for not just explicit racial bias, but implicit racial bias, because the law talks about somebody's reasonable perceptions, right? And so if somebody, because of racism in society, if not a specifically held racist belief, but just an implicit bias toward people of color, perceiving them as more threatening, and if jurors feel that way as well, you have the potential to excuse the use of deadly force against people in society based on racism. And I have to say, too, there's a long history of firearms regulation specifically tailored to political groups, including the Black Panthers, who sought to arm themselves and saw a backlash against the use and access of firearms because they were suddenly in the hands of people of color. And that prompted a wave of regulation of firearms back in the 60s and 70s. Of course, since then, we've had a much more loosening of those regulations, which leads to the kind of proliferation of guns that we have in the country now.
Thanks for that call, Ryan. Dante is with us now in Green Bay. Dante, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, do stand your ground laws or self-defense, do they still count if you initiated a physical altercation? Let's say you were angry, you got in a fight. Now you're in a fight you can't win, and now you got to shoot your way out of it. Do those laws still apply?
Dante, thanks for the call. Yeah, can I claim self-defense if I started the physical altercation in the first place, John?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, in Wisconsin, like in many other states, one of the factors that goes into evaluating whether or not you had a right to use self-defense was whether or not you provoked the encounter. And the law basically is if you did provoke the other person, if you did something that was illegal, right, and was likely to provoke them to attack you or get in a physical confrontation with you, you can't claim self-defense. You can't claim use of deadly force unless you have exhausted every opportunity to retreat from that situation. So yes, provocation does impact whether or not the law is going to recognize your right to use deadly force.
Thanks for that call. John, in just our last minute here, again, I listed those five different incidents over the course of just 1 week this month. Are you concerned that people are looking at our self-defense laws, misperceiving them, misconstruing them, and reaching for that gun way sooner than the law would allow as a result?
I mean, these recent cases certainly make the case for that argument. I mean, I think people may not understand when they are entitled to use self-defense. They may be confusing the laws of different states. They may also just be a situation where people are increasingly marginalized and engaging in less social interaction. I mean, I can't help but be old enough to remember when sometimes you had to stop and ask someone for directions. Mm-hmm. Now we have GPS, and so pulling into the wrong driveway is perceived as a threat by some people. But yes, I mean, I think these incidents highlight that people should be hesitating to use deadly force, not embracing the idea they have the right to use it.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's John Gross, clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. He joined us with a look at self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country, following a number of recent stories of young people being shot when they mistakenly approach the wrong house or vehicle. Coming up after the news, a law professor breaks down the U.S. Supreme Court's action on the abortion pill, mifepristone, and the next steps in the legal case. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.